Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
So welcome tonight to this very weighty topic, and I'm so excited to be here with these three brilliant women. We have Dr. Elisa Minkin, who's a board-certified pediatrician at Beach Pediatrics, which is a subsidiary of Allied Pediatrics. We have Dr. Marcy Forta, and she is the founder and director of ATSMI, which is a nonprofit organization that is created to support, you know, the mental health of Jewish girls through programs that improve their self-esteem, self-compassion, and acceptance. Not only that, she is also a body project facilitator and a certified holistic nutritionist. Last but not least, we have Yafi Lvova. Did I say that correctly? And in American, it would be Lvova. She is a registered dietitian nutritionist, and she's the owner of Baby Bloom Nutrition. She has published several books on feeding your infant, your baby, your toddler, and children in a healthy and joyful way. So tonight we're starting with that it's hard enough to deal with our own issues of our bodies, especially in a culture that is seemingly obsessed with thinness. And it's even harder when you're dealing with our children's bodies. So tonight we're going to be talking about obesity, food, weight control, and body image. So some of the responses to an Instagram post that was several weeks ago, and then a previous talk told us that so many of you deal with weight stigma and you want to stop feeling shame about your body. Whether you're joining for yourself or for your child, we hope that we will be able to share some practical information to help you and your family. And we're going to be taking your questions in chat, but we'll pretty much get to them to the end. So before I begin, I just want to say, this is my own personal thought, that in our number-obsessed culture, people tend to use weight kind of like a stock price. And it's a number that indicates publicly the overall health of your private body. And people like to make judgments. So I'm going to start with asking Dr. Elisa Minkin, who's one of my most favorite pediatricians, a little bit to talk to us about obesity and the idea of BMI, which is a body mass index. So that's a common thing that we hear about. And what's considered overweight?
You're muted.
Oh, you're muted.
Okay, try again. Okay, I'm really excited to be here. I am so proud to be part of this collaborative effort. And I think it's really important to be collaborating and not just to be in our own little bubble, like for me as a physician alone. So let me talk a little bit about BMI. And I love, Toby, how you mentioned that we're focusing on numbers and we're acting as if those numbers imply health. That is not true, but let me just define what the BMI is. The BMI stands for body mass index, and it is literally a calculation from the weight in kilograms divided by the height in meters squared. And that number is plotted out, and the definition of overweight for children is a BMI of 85th to 95th percentile. And of obesity is above the 95th percentile. And in adults, that corresponds to approximately overweight of a BMI of about 25 to about 30, and above 30 is considered obesity. But I just want to say very briefly, it's too big a topic to get into tonight, but understand that the BMI is being used as a proxy, as a stand-in, as a quick and dirty estimation of body fat, but it's very limited. So that's really important to understand, but that's what we're using.
So what I'm understanding from you is that there are some numbers, but they don't necessarily reflect what's actually happening. So one of the questions that we received, and I think that it would be great for you to answer, Dr. Minkin, is about some people have what's known as medical fat shaming. And can you explain what that might be for people who don't know what that is?
Medical fat shaming. So there's many different ways that we could be using that term for. One example would be you go to the doctor and you go for something other than your weight and you get talked about your weight. You need to lose weight. You weren't asked permission. Do you need to lose weight? You didn't even come for that reason. Other examples of that would be you're told, oh, you have a medical condition, but that's because you're fat. You need to lose weight. Basically being looked at as primarily your weight and not the human being that you are.
Wow. So it looks like that they're coming in for something else so that the fat becomes the problem to solve. But it's almost like that's a bullying statement. And that's kind of a challenging way to face a health problem.
Right. And it's also problematic because the doctor or other healthcare professional may just see the weight and the person may have another condition that may be missed. And that does happen. And that's a very, very serious problem. So that's important to keep in mind. I'm very concerned now because we have the new American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines that came out. And for all of us healthcare professionals, we are asked to look at that BMI, especially at a well visit, but sometimes at every visit, and that can easily overshadow the visit. And that's really problematic. I mean, the first thing I'm going to say is, as a patient, you should be asked permission. Is it okay to discuss this? I guess we can get to that later.
Wow. That's a great idea. And I would love to hear about that later. Dr. Forte Marcy, the next question is mostly for you. Another question that we received deals with what we call weight stigma or personal fat shaming. So one of the questions that we were asked is, what are the motivations of people who like look at you or say, have you tried intermittent fasting or, you know, you're fat, you know, can you explain a little bit about why people sometimes feel motivated to comment on other people's bodies?
Sure. I'd love to start that. I like Alisa, I'm very excited to be here and have this opportunity to kind of go through some of these really weighty and important topics. I would kind of like to step back a minute and say what weight stigma actually is. We talked about medical fat shaming, but weight stigma is really any discriminatory act that or a belief that is targeted towards somebody because specifically of their weight or size. So, you know, it could be somebody has an opportunity for a job because of the way they look and not based on their resume or their education, or they might get, for preferential treatment in some way because of that. And weight stigma is really associated with many very significant long-term emotional and physical consequences, especially for children who experience weight stigma. Some of the things that they'll tell you about weight stigma is not only does it undermine healthy behaviors, and preventative care, because like, Alisa was saying, people don't want to go to the doctor because they're afraid that they'll be shamed for their weight. But it also causes emotional distress, depressive symptoms, suicidality thoughts, low self-esteem, social isolation, eating disorders, disordered eating, and even is linked to an increased mortality risk. So weight stigma, bullying, shaming, whatever you want to call it, is a very dangerous pastime. I think in the past, people have felt that when they guilt somebody maybe into losing weight or explain to them, this is what you need to do, and they kind of guilt them into getting there, that they felt that would be a positive thing to help them. But what they're not realizing is that the long-term consequences of these types of conversations or behaviors, especially for children, are really devastating in the long term.
Yeah, what is, I think it's Maya Angelou, not that I'm quoting her, but the idea is that people never forget the way you made them feel. And so that when a question that we received that really made me pause was that sometimes it's familial interference. Sometimes it's the grandmother and, or somebody else in the family that you're close to that says these hurtful things. And thank you for letting us know that how painful it is. But is there a way for people to kind of navigate such complicated conversations?
Yes. So first, I would also love to say that I think a lot of the time that when parents or grandparents say things like this to their grandchildren, oftentimes they're really doing it because they think that they will save them pain down the road if they're able to help them today with this weight issue, that they struggled with the same thing and they don't want them to go through what it is they went through. So they figured if they head it off, you know, I compare it to a fishbowl. We're all really swimming in the same water. We've all grown up in the same cultures with the same expectations and the same issues kind of that comprise our body image. So it's really important to note that I don't think anyone's purposefully trying to hurt their child or grandchild, but sometimes we have to put parameters or boundaries around our relationships with people in saying, you know, we're not going to be commenting about our bodies in our family. If can you please respect this, or this is how we're choosing to raise our children. And I think that yes, for some families it might be a little more complicated, but for most they'll try to see it and be respectful of the fact that you're trying something different with your family. And if you really can't get them to change, then you might have to put limitations on your time with them or the types of interactions that you have with them, because it is so dangerous and devastating.
Wow. With that, I'd like to transition to talk a tiny little bit about body image. And JOMA, which is a fantastic organization, has done a video and a podcast that goes into much greater depth than we're going to be talking about here. So Marcy, if it's okay with you, I'd like to ask you a few questions, and the same with you, both Yaffe and Elisa, about body image. So Marcy, can you let us know, like, how is our body image made? You know what I'm saying? Like, we're
body
born.
Image, yeah. Right. It comes from a lot of places, but body image is actually not how your body looks, but it's how you think your body looks. So it's really important to differentiate that when you look at me, you can't see what my body image is. And when I look at you, I can't see what your body image is. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the fact of what our bodies look like. It's kind of an emotional feeling and connection with your body. It goes on in your own mind about your own body. Any feelings, emotional attitudes, beliefs that you hold about your appearance make up your body image. And your body image is comprised of many, many aspects, some of which, you know, I would love for Yaffe to speak to, but it comes from the appearance ideal. It comes from diet culture. It comes from weight stigma. It comes from our families, our peers, our cultural considerations. I would say pressures that we feel in our community, and even, you know, social media, or any type of social media is also a contributor.
So Yaffe, can you, because Marcy mentioned diet culture, can you tell us a little bit what that is, and that why diet culture is a risk factor for disordered eating and eating disorders? And can you explain the difference between the two? Because that's a really hard one for me. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll start off with the latter. So disordered eating and eating disorders, there's a fine line. And sometimes we as professionals take a little bit to determine where someone is if they're kind of straddling that line in between. Disordered eating could be something as light as just, you know, your regular dieting, or it could be more restrictive and get, it's kind of like a spectrum. Once you get to a certain point, it is an eating disorder, which is something that can be diagnosable. And that's back to Dr. Forte. That's not something that is in my scope as a dietitian. But going back to the other question of what is diet culture, diet culture is just the entire world around the idea that weight indicates our health. Mm. And it comes down to that. Health is complex, and we have been living with this idea that it's indicated, your level of health is indicated by weight. And if you're too skinny, or if you're too big, but mostly too big, because being too skinny has been and apparently is back in fashion again. I mean, don't get me started. But you know, being too big, that is the problem. And we don't have to worry about interpersonal connections. We don't have to worry about lab values or sleep, you know, quality of sleep or any of that. We don't have to worry about any of that because we just look at weight. It's really problematic, and it causes people to not want to go to the doctor. You know, Marcy was talking about the person's experience when they're larger and they go to the doctor, and Elisa mentioned when diagnoses can be missed. I have personally had to talk up friends to convince them, you know, to give them the chutzpah to go to the doctor, because a friend was going for pain in her knees and her ankles, and she knew that it wasn't her weight, but she had, like, I had to talk her up. I had to be her cheerleader just to get her to go, because it's so depressing hearing time after time, just lose weight, just lose weight. It's such a complicated thing. And that comes back to that weight stigma. You know, it doesn't feel like a big thing to tell someone, oh, hey, maybe you should lose a few pounds. But consider how often that person heard that day. That, you know, that person, when leaving their house, has to take a few deep breaths and think, is it safe to leave? And they don't know whether it is or not. You know, they don't know what kind of comments are going to come their way, because people do feel entitled to those comments, you know, because they're,
you know, it makes me think that it's like a fire hose that is just filled with thousands of tiny humiliations that are hitting people on a consistent level, and how painful that must be. And I also think to myself that for, I would say most people don't have what I would call like medical equipment in their home, but everybody has pretty much a scale. They even have scales in supermarkets that you can weigh yourself. It's, I think, the only metric that we allow everyone to measure themselves by. And it's like you're all saying, it's not the measure of the whole person. I want to jump to this idea. You're interrupting me.
I'm interrupting. I'm sorry. No, I just want to say that even though the higher you get and the BMI number, the more it is correlated with various what we call comorbidities, like high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. Correlated doesn't mean one-to-one. So your weight doesn't correlate one-to-one with your health at all. You can be thin and have all kinds of problems, including those problems I just mentioned. And you can have quite elevated BMI and have none of them. And so I think that's really important when people say, but your health.
Oh, so you're saying the number on the scale doesn't reflect necessarily the internal health.
Right. There is a correlation. The higher you get in the BMI, particularly 30 and above or 95th percentile and above, but it's not a one-to-one correlation. Mm. I have plenty of patients with elevated BMIs who are what we call metabolically healthy. All of those parameters are normal. And we have plenty of people who are in the normal weight or just slightly elevated weight who have those problems. So we really have to stop using weight as a proxy for health, because it is not a one-to-one correlation at all.
And I think that's the danger of diet culture, because it's almost, weight loss is a means to a higher status in diet culture. The whole idea is that the thinner you are, that's best for you. But weight loss does not equal health. They are not the same thing. So it's really important sometimes to separate out some of these beliefs that we hold when they're not necessarily true, right? You know, thinness is valued over our physical and mental, emotional health. That is like the end all goal of diet culture. And the expectation is that controlling your body, particularly through your diet, by limiting what you eat, how much you eat, is praiseworthy and it's expected. And it's just the norm of what we should be doing day to day. So again, that just that confusion part with a diet being correlated with getting healthy. They're not the same thing, and they don't equal the same thing at all.
This came up in a conversation recently where someone asked me about an all potato diet. All potato.
My gosh. Okay.
And I just looked at her and said, do you think the way to health is through undernourishing yourself? And she said, of course not. Yeah, well, of course, but that's what we're talking about. Dieting for weight loss is intentional undernourishment. And I'm not saying that, we look at other values in order to determine progress. It's not saying I hate you if you're on a diet. It's not saying, you know, I don't care if you're allergic to peanuts, eat them anyway, because I say all foods are good. No, that's not how this game, you know, that's not. we should adopt healthy habits because healthy habits lead to health. Whether they change the scale or not, healthy habits lead to health. That's it.
Right. I think we need to talk about diets versus dieting.
Mm. Yes.
I think that distinction needs to be made. And I would love for Yaffe to make that as the nutritionist.
Yeah. So I would love it if the word diet was neutral. You know, like we say the kosher diet, that's a neutral thing. We say the vegetarian diet, it's neutral. But when we talk about, like, if I were to say to someone, how is your diet? Even though if I used it in a neutral way, it comes across in this very charged, what are you doing to lose weight? So I try to stay away from that word altogether just because it is so charged. And so dieting is just the act of being on a diet. The reason why I am against going on a diet specifically with the goal of weight loss is because we have significant evidence that a very high percentage of diets fail. And failing means that within 5 years, you gain the weight back. Also, we have research to say it's usually more than that weight. So you lose the weight, you gain more, and then you want to yo-yo. You know, you want to go again because you were successful last time. So I'm going to try again. I failed last time, but I'm not going to fail this time. So you go on the diet, but it's not sustainable because guess what? It's not you failing. It's the diet failing. But we also have conclusive evidence that yo-yo dieting, that your weight going like this, is harmful in and of itself. So putting someone on their very first diet, to me, is like at the top of the roller coaster, just pushing, because that's what I'm starting. I want to look at other values. I want to look at, did your vitamin D go up when we made an intervention? How's your energy level? Are you sleeping at night? You know, this is so much more meaningful.
And I think also it's important to know, which Alisa can probably speak more to, but the studies show that any period of time that you put a young child or a child going through puberty on a calorie restricted or nourishment restricted diet, there will be consequences, physical and mental consequences. There will be impairment, and they will struggle to hit their, you know, developmental goals during puberty. So, you know, it's really important that they get the nutrition that they need. Their brains are maturing, their bodies are maturing, they're going through puberty, they're doing a lot of growth. Dieting is very, very contraindicated in children.
It is, regardless of the recent AAP. I couldn't be angrier about that because it speaks. See, Alisa's, look, Alisa's crying. We made Alisa cry.
Sorry.
It speaks to an extreme focus on the physical, a complete lack of focus on the psychological. And it doesn't account for the fact that hormones are made of fat and the protection around neurons is made of fat and your brain is made of fat. And this is a time when there is immense growth physically and mentally. And just to echo, Marcy, what you said, food restriction during this time has cognitive effects. It has cognitive effects.
Mm-hmm. Right. I really want to hear Dr. Forda speak about the triggers of eating disorders, because the AAP guidelines said very blithely, oh, don't worry, you're not going to trigger an eating disorder by talking about weight, by, you know, starting kids on whatever program you're talking about. However, they do deep down in the bowels of the 100-page full guidelines that no pediatrician is going to have time to read, say that actually kids and families on their own are quite likely to trigger an eating disorder, as opposed to the kind of programs where it might be done with a lot of support, which don't exist for the most part. So I would love to hear what Dr. Forta has to say on that.
I mean, there are a lot of triggers for eating disorders. Some of the, you know, it's difficult because if you take girl A and girl B, and they're pretty much the same in a lot of ways, and the risk factors are the same, girl A may develop an eating disorder, but girl B may not. So sometimes there's a lot of genetic predisposition around eating disorders. They're finding that it's really highly genetically correlated. Even up to 60% of your risk actually is genetically predetermined. So if you think of it in those terms, you think about diabetes or Crohn's or celiac disease that are highly genetic disorders where something triggers the onset of the disorder. And that's kind of what happens with an eating disorder. But the triggers can be quite intense for people who are susceptible to an eating disorder. Now, those surgeries and those gastric banding surgeries or some of those weight loss surgeries for young girls, they have found those to actually be triggering for an eating disorder. Body dissatisfaction, having negative body image, these are the greatest risks for eating disorders. How does that come about? How is that created? You know, in our communities, we have some risk factors that might manifest a little bit differently. I'm not going to say that they're completely different because they're not from the general public, but they manifest a little bit differently. And weight stigma is definitely one of them, but eating disorders in particular are stigmatized in our community. If someone loses weight and starts to lose weight, they get a lot of praise for that. And even if it's a disordered eating situation, people are fine with it. But when it crosses over to that diagnosable disorder, then there's a lot of stigma around that. And that can be a kind of a trigger as well. But really, there's a lot of pressures in our community also that are unfortunately, risk for eating disorders. You know, we have a ton of academic pressure. We want the girls to get good grades. We want them to get into certain schools. I mean, this is for all kids, obviously, but some of them are more female oriented, but there's a lot of academic pressure in our community. There's a lot of thin pressure. We have something called the superwoman ideal, where a lot of the girls that I talk to, you know, they think that when I speak to them about imperfection, they tell me their mothers are perfect. Their mothers have a baby, come back from having that baby. They're already cooking dinner, doing the homework, going back to work, having company. They don't see the real struggle that goes on behind the scenes. And we model this to our children, not realizing we obviously don't want them to see bad things. But when they see that life isn't perfect, when they encounter that in their own lives, which is obviously inevitable, then it isn't as dramatic for them or traumatic, because we do have this kind of built in like shame around asking for help. We're a very secretive kind of community where we don't like to share certain things, and that's appropriate. But if you have an issue or something that you're struggling with, to teach your child that it's not okay to ask for help or that you shouldn't talk about it, these things are very difficult for our children. That's the honest truth. So modeling is huge, especially when a mother struggles with her own body image. This is a very big risk for a girl for an eating disorder. If she's talking down about her body, you know, the studies show that girls under 8 years of age sometimes can't actually disconnect their own body from their mother. So when their mother is talking bad about her body, they're kind of connecting it to their own body because they can't really disconnect those pieces. They don't really understand what that difference is. And so it is so important, especially up to the age of 11. I'm sure, you know, Elisa, you know, developmentally, a child until the age of 11 is very connected to their parents, what their parents say. Once we hit 11, it's the peers who really are very influential in their lives. But we have a lot of thin pressure. That's another pressure that we have. Another one, which I'm going to stop in a minute because I don't want to only talk about these things, but we have a lot of mixed messages sometimes that we give our girls. So we talk about the fact that it is our neshama, our connection to Hashem, that is actually that is the most primary important thing. Yet we often model that being thin, looking beautiful, you know, having these physical perfections are more important. We do that in the Shidduch system. We do that in even academia. We just tell, you know, even complimenting people. If you think about how you compliment people or little girls, what do you say? You look so beautiful. Your dress is so beautiful. Your hair bow is so beautiful. We have to kind of step back from that and stop only talking about people's physical appearance. And this also is a very big risk for girls because they want that reinforcement, whether it's from their mother or their father or a grandparent. They love it. It feels good and they want to continue it. So that kind of gets them into this cycle of continuing to not eat. And there are several more. I don't know if you want to go into them all, but there are a lot of risk factors for eating disorders that can be very difficult for girls.
And this you're saying stems from, there's a lot of factors, of course, but diet culture, in other words, putting kids early on a diet can help bring about these sorts of things.
Putting them on a diet or even talking badly about your own body in front of them, even if you don't put them on a diet, if you shame people, if you judge people in your home, you guys talk about this person as being fat or this person as lazy. Sometimes people equate those two things or not having self-control. Sometimes we talk negatively about people like that and your children pick up on how you feel about those things. It isn't only about putting them on a diet. It's really about how do you treat all people. How do you treat your body? This is how they learn to treat their body, from how you treat yours.
So it's kind of like modeling the right behavior from the get-go, so that what your kids are seeing, that they can actually become.
Yes,
in other words, right. Yeah. So that they're getting their information from you. So I want to just transition to something that I thought was really important. And I don't know if any of you have felt this, that a lot of the thought around weight is kind of like a battle, like it's a war. And if any of you have done color war, hopefully none of us have been in real war, but like with color war, there's always like slogans. And those slogans represent an enormous amount of information in a very short, like pithy statement. So like, these are some of my favorites. So tell me if some of these resonate with you, because I want to jump into exactly what you were talking about. And I'd love all of you to chime in with this idea. So these are some of them, like no pain, no gain. In other words, you have to suffer to look a certain way. A moment on the lips and a lifetime on the hips. So in other words, you have transitory pleasure, but you will pay for it forever and ever. This is another one. Nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. In other words, restriction, like you were saying, undernourishment is the way to go. And this is my favorite, this is my absolute favorite, is inside every fat person is a skinny person just waiting to get out, as if we're deliberately keeping the skinny person hidden inside. So the reason I bring these up is because anytime you're in some sort of a battle, part of it is management and control. And I would love for you to talk about the myth of control and how to eat. And so why I say this is because we all know what food is. Hopefully everybody here on this call and on the live stream knows what food is. But we want to talk about what food isn't. And because what food isn't goes to what control is. So Yaffe, can you talk about what food isn't? So for a lot of people, we know food is nourishment, but if we're undernourishing, what is that saying?
If we're undernourishing, it could be saying a lot of things. I recently learned that a significant amount of eating disorders actually starts after the age of 40, because eating disorders crop up at different times in your life when there are different life changes. And so a woman who is, let's say, in my age and circumstances with small children and trying to balance all the things and doing all the things, can forget to eat. And it over and over, and or can seek control with food in a more intentional way. There are different ways problems can start and different ways they can come about. You know, food, I think food is everything. Honestly, my own therapist tells me that I should do something that has nothing to do with food, because even the novels that I read have to do with food, you know, like I just like it. It's everything to me. I know that's not everyone. It's not healthy for everyone to be like that, you know, can't have a million Yaffes. But we need to come to a place where we can approach food with comfort and treat eating like we treat our other biological functions. You know, I'm very often asked, or I receive comments about having self-control when it comes to food. And people are surprised. I say, we don't need self-control when it comes to food. It's food. We don't need self-control when it comes to breathing, you know, unless you're in a yoga class. Strong recommend. But, you know, throughout the day, you don't need to micromanage your breathing. You don't need to look at the clock and say, oh, it's been 2 hours, I need to go pee. Like, we trust our bodies. We trust our bodies with these things. We trust our bodies when it tells us we're tired. You know, we trust it enough to say, ha ha, I'm going to keep doing the dishes anyway. We might ignore the signals, but we listen and we value those signals. It's only eating when we think that we have to have self-control. I don't think we need self-control with it. In fact, we need to take away the control. It's not about having more control. It's not about knowing more about your food and controlling your food more. It's about taking a step back and listening to the instruction manual that God gave us. that the first thing that a baby does out right out of the womb is latch at the breast. We know how to recognize hunger and how to make ourselves satisfied. And it's the only biological signal that we battle from that point forward.
Marcy, I wanted you to talk about how people make, we'll call them, moral judgments about food. Because what Yathi was talking about kind of goes with a lot of moral judgment.
Yeah, there is a lot of moral judgment around food. We call food good or bad. We call people good or bad based on the choices of the food that they make, right? I love what Yathi said about our relationship with food, because oftentimes we use food as a reward or a punishment. And so when we use food as a reward over and over, you're disrupting a child's ability to recognize and honor their own hunger cues, right? You're kind of teaching them that food is not used as a tool to nourish your body. When you use food for things that it's not meant to be used for, it doesn't mean that you can't have a treat or a fun food, whatever you want to call it. It doesn't mean that at all. It simply means that sometimes in our school situations or our home situations, you know, if a child does something every single time, they'll get a candy for that, or every single time. You're teaching them that's how they soothe themselves. This is how they get feedback. This is how they regulate their emotions. We're not using food as a tool. Hashem gave us food to nourish our bodies. We're supposed to have it three times a day. We use it in simchas, right? We have it at beautiful times of our life. And it's a family, fun, connected kind of thing. There's nothing bad about it. I think that it's important that we use it as a tool correctly, and we let our bodies understand the cues that it's telling us when we're hungry, when we're thirsty, when we're full, when we're tired. These are all things that we have to become more in tune with to our body. And in eating disorder, oftentimes people think that food is the eating disorder, but actually food is how people take back control around their emotions, because they don't feel that they have an outlet otherwise. They don't know how to communicate these difficult and complex emotions. And so they're using food as their tool. So part of what you have to do when you help somebody with an eating disorder is give them these other ways of dealing with their emotions. A lot of people use food to help them cope with their emotions. We need to kind of recreate that relationship, because there's nothing wrong with enjoying food, but we don't want to use it as a crutch to make us feel better. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I had a question that any one of you could answer, because we were talking about how, Yathi, you were saying that we don't need a reminder to breathe, and unless like we're doing a yoga class, and we don't need reminders for certain things. But how is it that we've lost our natural body's cues of when we're hungry or when we're full? Like, is there, yeah.
Sorry. I've been wanting to say something, so that's as good as a segue as I'm going to get. Because we have a lot of questions that are typical questions that a pediatrician gets, and I'm going to read them from our list because I want to get back to that. How can I control my child's portions? What if they want seconds and thirds, you know, and the doctor told me they weigh too much? How can I motivate my child to lose weight? What should my children eat? How can I get my child to eat less junk food, stop sneaking foods, et cetera? These are the kind of things that I, as a pediatrician, get asked. And by the way, it starts from birth with talking about feeding. I find this particularly with bottle feeding, because the advantage to direct breastfeeding is the baby can choose on their own when to start, when to stop. The parent will say, I'm feeding 2 ounces every 2 hours. Should I go up to 3 ounces every 2 hours? You know, so on and so forth. The focus is very much on what I'm giving to the baby in quantifiable. In other words, I'm controlling, right? Mm. And then I'm trying to control the child from not eating junk. I'm trying to control the child's snack portions. And I think we have to flip that question around. I would really love to hear from Yathi on responsive feeding. I quote you every day, Yathi, every day. But before I forget, I want to mention this book that I promised that I would mention, that I literally got from the library today. It's called OMG, You Think I'm Fat, by Madeline Burke, who's a registered dietitian. And that title came from a teenager who was going to college, and the parent gave them a gift of an exercise bike to take with them to college. And her response was, OMG, you think I'm fat. So I think that all of this control is completely backwards. And the question should be flipped back to the parent. And I would love to hear from Yafi about the responsive feeding. That is what I talk about from day one.
Yeah. Wow. Responsive feeding. Well, if there are any other professionals who are on here, I'm actually going to be doing a lecture on responsive feeding with a speech therapist and an occupational therapist. So that's a very well-rounded perspective of that. And that's a continuing education thing as well. So responsive feeding is the idea, I'm going to boil it down. The child communicates and the parent responds. That's actually responsive parenting. It's just responsive. It's being responsive in general. But responsive feeding is that there's an ongoing relationship between the parent and the child regarding feeding, and that you don't stick to any kind of harsh rules other than those put in place for safety, you know, choking hazards, allergens, whatnot. But that you take just a natural approach at feeding. That could be breast or bottle feeding. It could be purees or baby-led weaning or any kind of mix. But it's the idea that that you are at the table with your child having a food conversation.
I'd like to say one thing about control also as well, just to add to this, because I think sometimes parents think they're doing the right thing when they take control, saying you may not eat this food, or we will not have this food in our house, or you may not have seconds, or you may not do this. So first of all, I can promise you, if you tell a child, you know, we don't eat this food in our home, they're getting it somewhere else. They're getting it from their friends. They're trading. They're using their allowance money. They're going to a friend's house and eating it. They are eating that food. The more you say that they can't have it, the more they want that food. The more you make it less of a problem and something that, you know, we have it in our home. We eat it when it's appropriate. It's part of, you know, a well-rounded diet. You know, then it's fine. But when we tell a child also, we take food away from them if they're still hungry, or we tell them that they're not hungry, they're not allowed to have a second helping. That's when we are kind of confusing the cues for them, because they're thinking to themselves, geez, there must be something wrong with me because I'm actually still hungry, but I'm not supposed to be hungry. We create this relationship with food because of our issues with it or what we think that they need. But honestly, if we help them learn how to regulate their own appetite, there will be times when they will need more fuel. When they're going through puberty, they will be gaining weight, and that's normal and healthy and expected. So the idea of control is, I think that what we're saying is that you shouldn't take complete control. For instance, I spoke to a lady whose daughter had asthma, and she told me, she's 11 years old, she was managing the asthma through her diet. The girl didn't take any medication for it, but she was on a very strict diet. She got a call from school that she was stealing food from people's lockers, from their lunches. The mother called me, she was very open. And I said, you know, you have to let her have some control around her choices. It might mean she might need some medication. Are you willing to do that so that she doesn't feel desperate enough to go and take it from other people? Let's try it. It has to be appropriate control for the age and the child. That's something that a parent has to determine, but she was able to give her back some control. She needed to go on a small dose of the medication, but the child stopped immediately. She just said, I just wanted to be able to eat X, Y, and Z. We can't take complete control because then we're not even allowing our children to determine what is good for me. What is my body telling me? What am I supposed to be having? When we take those away, that's when the problems start.
And that comes back to responsive feeding, because responsive feeding is the way that you teach your child to trust their own body. Because from day one, you're telling them, I'm honoring the messages you're telling me. And so they're getting the message. What I'm hearing and communicating, what I'm hearing from my body and telling my parent is valuable. And so they never get to that point where they say, they are the kid at the table saying, well, there must be something wrong with me. I'm still hungry and the meal is over, because they have that dynamic in the house that they are trusted. And because of that, they do better with feeding their own kids, and they are less likely to have all of these anxieties related to food.
Is it the same thing, like when you're saying that they have the cue that they're still hungry, that in some families, you can't leave the table until your plate is finished? So in other words, you're being forced to eat more than your body is actually telling you that you want.
Yes.
Is that in the same category?
That is in the category of things we are trying to grow past as a society, because that's an external signal, and we go with internal signals. You know, an internal signal is hunger, an internal signal is fullness, and then another one is satiety, which sometimes comes at the same time as fullness, and sometimes it's Shavuos and there's a cheesecake, and well, I might be full, but I'm having a couple more bites anyway.
Well, that's what I call the dessert paradox, that you feel so full that you have to undo the top button, but then dessert comes out and suddenly there's an extra storage space that you never knew about. So, you know,
and that's a reason why a lot of parents are now serving dessert with dinner for their kids, because really? It neutralizes it. You know, otherwise you're telling the kids, okay, here's all of the food, get full. Okay, now here's dessert. And so you should make yourself overfull for dessert. You know, in my house, I don't like serving dessert at the same time as dinner because we're in Arizona. A lot of times dessert melts. And I don't think that dessert that has a natural timer set in should, you know, it's natural pressure. You know, don't worry about the dessert on the table while it melts. Right. So I'll tell the kids, you know, we're having dessert, it's ice cream. And then they'll know to leave some room. But yeah, it's good to neutralize foods for that reason.
So we're taking away kind of the categories that puts food into very specific places, that these are treats and this is real food, and that the treats are much more desirable than the real food. So one of the things that we didn't really talk about, and that's one of the top questions that I think we got, is what should people eat? Like, what should they eat? You know, you mentioned the all potato diet. I've heard of that one. I don't think it's a good one. And I never really heard it as undernourishment, but that really struck me, that you're deliberately inducing like the starvation state into your body. And that I'm like, if people who don't know me, I do a lot of lecturing to girls who are in puberty. And I had told these lovely ladies that I'm on with tonight that they're packing for the journey. So sometimes there are times in life where we go through stress or we're going through growth periods that there will be a little bit of weight gain to pack for the journey. But once the journey's over, that weight should naturally go away. But that's if everything is kind of normal. And so when people say, what should they eat? Do you have any suggestions for people? And this is not to give, you know, direct advice to anybody, but it's kind of like a general idea.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because everything is bad for someone. I could say drink more water, and it's going to be absolutely awful advice for, you know, everyone who's on dialysis, for example.
Right.
So that being said, general good advice is to eat as many plants as possible. You know, put as many plants in your diet as you can, but that's to say, add things. Don't take away ice cream night. You know, don't take away family favorites. And by the way, do not sneak vegetables into any food, but specifically family favorites. Do not take your child's favorite food and like hide peas in there. Don't mess with their favorites. But plants, have them on the table. You know, as a convenience food, you can go to a supermarket and get a party platter of vegetables and just take off the top and wow, look, it's a salad. It's a deconstructed salad. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy. A lot of kids who don't like vegetables, you know, quote unquote, don't like vegetables, they like them raw. They like them with some kind of dip. It's loud, it's crunchy. It's really engaging. Hummus. Yeah, tzina, hummus. Sriracha, like whatever it is for the kid, ranch, you know, just plants. It's good.
But make it easy. I like the idea of if you have to buy it pre-made. It doesn't have to be a wide variety.
Yeah.
I love the idea of putting it out when the kids are waiting for dinner so that they have that to grab. Because like, you know, I interviewed Marian Essel on the JOMA podcast. And she said, we really have to make the healthy choice the easy and less expensive choice.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of societal changes, that's a separate issue. But in our own lives, like, we can really do this. We can make it easier for our kids and ourselves to eat healthier. And by the way, food should be fun and yummy.
It should be. Yeah. So here,
it doesn't have to be, the healthy food is the not yummy food that you eat when you're on a diet.
No, no, diets don't get all the veggies. Like, you got to experiment. I started making vegetables in my air fryer, and wow, I'm just going to get like 10 air fryers and I don't need anything else ever. yeah. Oh, it's going to be bad. So, well, now I just got myself off track thinking about all my new air fryers.
I also think, right, just by virtue of offering these kinds of things to your kids, even if they're not eating them when you're offering them the first time or the second time or the third, they're there and they see that everyone in the family has them. Some of my kids, you know, didn't love vegetables when they were little. I'm a big vegetable person, but now that they're older, I see that they incorporate it in everything. It's an important part of who they are. You know, it takes time for them to develop a taste. They have to try it a few times to get that taste. Vegetables are a harder taste. You know, so you just have to kind of give them that option a lot, and they will develop a taste for it.
Right. And you can roast it. You can roast it with olive oil. It doesn't have to be raw. So my family loves roasted vegetables.
Really modeling. Modeling is everything. Lately, my kids, if I eat something and I am clearly enjoying it, they want a bite. I realize they're getting, like, it's more and more getting clear that if I make some kind of sound or something, then they want some of that. So just get into it, have food that you enjoy and enjoy it with them and enjoy it together and eat like you like each other.
Oh, I love that. Cause they say that when you eat together and there's a happy feeling, it's a joyful dinner. Yeah. I personally believe that those calories work in a much better way. They're much more effective. When my kids were little, I actually implemented something that I called it the 1-2-3 rule. Breakfast, there was one vegetable. Lunch, there were two vegetables. And dinner, there were three vegetables. And so what ended up happening is that every day they had a lot of vegetables, like you said, plants. And then this way they would get the nutrition, even if they were eating, you know, not as well. I had one child that only ate white food for like 2 years. So
that is really
he had white vegetables, like potatoes. So, but he did. So I think what we're all saying is that we have to make it easy for ourselves and easy for the kids to see us enjoying things. So
I just want to say also that children under the age of 5 often go through a period where they don't want to try anything that resembles a vegetable. Like you mentioned, the white food diet. There's this theory that back in the age of the cavemen, when they left their cave, you know, they had this neophobia or this fear of new food, so they wouldn't get poisoned. Mm. It's all made up. It doesn't matter. The basic idea, though, is that they go through this phase where they don't want to try anything and they survive. They're fine. You can give them a multivitamin. I do a lot of counseling to try to remove the anxiety because I feel like this is where eating issues can start when parents are putting pressure on them. You have to eat your fruit. You have to eat your vegetables. You have to take just one bite. And I think this pressure alone can cause problems.
Yeah. And resentment for that food and a bad relationship, again, with the cues. Mm-hmm. When we teach them what the food is for, you know, what do you feel, you know, if you're going outside to play, to do running or to play, do something endurance related. So what kind of nourishment do you need now to give your body to have the strength for that? Or you're going to study for a test. What do you think would be good for your body right now? And they might not agree with you and they might choose something else, but you're giving them choices and you're giving them options and you're teaching them what the food is used for and how to use it in the proper way. And I think that that's key to their relationship with it.
Right. Right. And you're giving it without shame. You're just giving,
correct.
You're just absolutely giving over neutral information and they pick up on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that thought that we're just making it neutral because it feels like I'm sure you've heard this before, but the word diet has die in it. You know, it's like, it's not a way to live. It's a way to, it robs the joy of life because it's so restrictive. And now thinking back, for all those people that used to diet, they were undernourished. No wonder they were in such a bad mood. You know, it doesn't do well for families.
It affects everything.
It really does. It really does. So we're kind of winding it down, but we're getting to the real meat of the matter. And these are some practical solutions. So we've already given you some to kind of neutralize food and to kind of have this idea that we don't supercharge the idea of food, that it's a reward or a punishment. Food is not inherently good or bad. It's just a tool. It's energy for your body to move. But But the number one questions that people get, or that people have written in and we've gotten, deal with what I would call navigation. And navigation is, these are the three questions that we've gotten the most. And so we can all, you know, answer them. But basically is, what's the best way to help ourselves and or our overweight or obese child? Are there things that we should say or not say? And I'll repeat these again, because I know I'll forget them myself. And then lastly, how do we create a really healthy environment for me, myself, and the family? So who can start with, how can I help myself? Let's say it's myself that wants to live a healthier lifestyle. I just don't know where to begin because my relationship with food and my relationship with my body is not where it needs to be.
So I think that's the first key, because I think Alfie can speak to the food, but I think that your relationship with your body is a very important part of how you deal with your food and how you relate to your food. And so, you know, just like we talked about neutrality around food, I don't like the concept of saying we're all going to have a positive body image. We're all working to develop a neutral body image because no one feels positive about their body all the time. We want to realize that it's an important part of who we are, but it's not the most important part. And it's not the most valuable or lovable part of us. So if you are struggling with your food choices, besides the food choices, you also have to get help for your body image. And that is really important too, because you can't always create or develop that relationship with food when you have a very negative relationship with your body.
It's very true. You can't nourish yourself if you don't value yourself.
Correct.
Can you repeat that? Because that was really important.
You can't nourish yourself if you don't value yourself.
So I think what I'm hearing is that before you even look at food and what food choices you should make, is look at yourself first.
Yeah.
And try to heal yourself a little bit first. So is that like understanding the cues? In other words, knowing what your body is asking for? What does that look like?
I think first you have to understand what your body is meant to be for. We have to take it all the way back, you know, what Hashem gave us our bodies for. A lot of times when I speak to the girls about their body being as important as their neshama, because it's the vehicle that Hashem gave us to carry our neshama through our life. It is a really difficult concept for the girls to understand or to value. Their feeling is, no, it's like a plastic bag and the neshama is like a gold bar. But you actually can't carry the gold bar, let's say, without the bag. You have to take care of it. So first we talk about the importance of our physical bodies, how amazing they are, all the wonderful, amazing things they do for us each and every day, and how Hashem gave them to us, entrusted them to us, actually, for this purpose. And so once we kind of value our bodies for what they're meant to do, and not only about what they look like on the outside or how they appear, then we already start to develop something a little bit different with our bodies, right? We're already thinking about them in a different way. So that's the first thing we try to deal with the girls, is just kind of help them understand all the intricacies of their body. If you take even your eyes apart, there's 100 things you could say about your eyes. They're such an important muscle in so many ways. We just take one part of the body and we just take it apart. This actually reinforces the value of our physical bodies. Then once you realize how important your bodies are, then the idea of how you nourish them and take care of them properly, that becomes the primary focus.
I love that. I never even thought of it that way, that you just take just even one part, like your hands, let's say, that they're this incredible engineering marvel. Mm-hmm. And I don't ever say anything bad about my hands, you know, because they're so amazing. But imagine if we were able to appreciate our bodies that way, then food would naturally be to nourish it and to make it incredibly healthy. For all of you that are on the Zoom, there's two fantastic files that you can look at. One is Brainless Veggies, and the other is a flyer for a weight problem that you can take a look at and download. And it's free from Yaffe, who is just amazing. And she's providing it for you so that you can keep it forever. It's not just a free event. You get free gifts too. The next thing is, and Alisa, you could also talk to this because you deal a lot with parents who are very concerned, or the moms themselves may be concerned about themselves. Are there words that you as a pediatrician say, and then Yaffe and Marcy as well, are there things that you can say or are things that you shouldn't say? Because words can be demoralizing or incredibly motivating.
That's a really good question. And I think it gets to the root of that we have to deal with obesity. We have to deal with it, but we have to deal with it in a way that is sensitive, not stigmatizing, that won't cause more harm than good. So I know as a pediatrician, I will not bring up the topic without the parents' permission. Although I will say as a physician, it's really hard. It's like walking on eggshells because I do have, you know, a short visit and I am expected to go through these things, A, and B, there are often health issues that come up. So what I'm trying to do more is focus on healthy habits and health issues that are associated and not on the number. I do not talk about numbers. I think it's also important not to talk to the child or in front of the child about weight. Some parents will take me aside before the visit or call me, or sometimes I'll call them after and have that discussion because we know that that can be very damaging. That can cause eating disorders, that can lead to more anxiety and depression in addition to the problem of the weight itself. But I think we can address these, but I think we need to do it in a more ideally comprehensive, multidisciplinary way, which doesn't exist for a lot of us. So what I say is build your team. You know, try to find, like, I give Yaffe's resources every single day from the earliest ages. I'm trying to find more nutritionists that will not add to the problem because not all nutritionists are created equal, right? I want a non-diet nutritionist. I do not want my kids and young teens to be going on diets. So these are the things that I'm doing. Again, I'm going to push this book again that I just read today because everything is in the 67-page book. It's so short. It's called OMG, You Think I'm Fat. And it talks about all the things that parents and relatives shouldn't say. And also there's a chapter just for pediatricians, which I'm sharing with my pediatrician colleague. There's a lot of work to be done. And again, I've mentioned the AAP guidelines. It's not making it easier. And we haven't even touched the concept of bariatric surgery or medication. It's outside the scope of what we're doing.
Can I just say that part of their sales pitch for bariatric surgery is malabsorption, that's a good thing. They're saying that like it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring up, though, that there's a range of situations here, and they are talking about that for the kids who are at least 120% above the 95th percentile of the BMI. That's what they're saying. So, you know, there are different situations, and some parents are listening to this, and they're like, well, my child is 100 pounds above their appropriate weight. That's a very different situation than a child who's maybe put 10 pounds that they needed going into puberty, for example, or might be, you know, 15 to 20 pounds above what's considered their ideal body weight. Every situation is different. And I do recommend working with your physician or other healthcare professional. We are not here to give medical advice. It's really important to do that. But I also think that you have to be your child's best advocate. Unfortunately, a lot of us are not trained and to talk about this really. These guidelines have really upended the previous guidelines, which is that teens and children should not be on diets. The focus was on being, you know, non-stigmatizing and supportive and healthy habits alone. I forgot, let's just talk until I remember what else I was going to say.
I think sometimes, though, you know, when we just address the health implications of somebody who is very obese or however you want to clinically term it, a child in that situation also could use some mental health help, right, as well, generally. And so, you know, just looking at the child from a physical perspective and not also addressing the mental health need of that child will not actually long-term, even besides the malabsorption or maybe some of the other issues that aren't tested and tried over the years, but it doesn't address the core of maybe what's going on with the child, that they actually got to that place, that eating is something that is a comfort for them in so many ways. So you're still going to have to address the body image issue, the food feeding cues, getting back in tune with their bodies. These things still will have to be addressed ultimately, because you can't have physical health without mental health. Yeah. Health is comprised of both.
Right. I love what you said, that we really should have every well visit have the child see the doctor, other healthcare professional, and a nutritionist and a mental health professional. How have I, we should get that kind of multi, you know, disciplinary care. But I think if your child is struggling with weight issues, then try to put that together, patch it together for them. And I know what I was going to say. I was going to say, again, back to being your child's best advocate is, when you go to the doctor, you know, before you go, make sure you take the doctor, you know, aside, or you have to keep standing up for your child that they don't get, you know, medically fat shamed. You have to stand up for your child that they don't get fat shamed in other situations, and you shouldn't do it yourself.
And honestly, that's the truth with eating disorders as well, because so many parents have taken their kids over and over to the doctor saying something is wrong. She's struggling in some way, and the doctor will purely look at BMI or other indicators and not listen to the parent. And I cannot tell you how many stories I have heard personally of people who 2 years later of going back to the doctor, and now their child's in a severe eating disorder situation requiring inpatient hospitalization. Their organs are starting to be affected. Their electrolytes are not balanced. Their low blood pressure, it's affecting every system of their body. So I agree with you 100%. You are your child's best advocate. If you think there is something wrong with your child and your doctor doesn't agree with you, find another doctor. You know, that's your job. You are the trusted adult in your parent's life. So it's so important for an eating disorder to get early treatment.
Right. And it's also very important to understand that, again, weight doesn't mean health in terms of eating disorders. You can have a normal weight and have an eating disorder.
Absolutely. Actually, the numbers show only 6% of people with an eating disorder are actually diagnosed as underweight. So a lot of times we think, oh, we see an emaciated person. She has an eating disorder. That's not how it works.
Right. And also it's very important that we're careful, because unfortunately, what happens is if the child does lose weight, we often jump on it and say, wow, that's fantastic. And I think one of the most classic but sad stories of an eating disorder starts with the child being a little technically overweight, losing weight, and getting praise for it.
And they get a lot of praise for it, a lot of praise for it.
Yeah, I'm getting calls like that right now where there are kids who are actively losing weight. Thankfully, in these situations, the parents are concerned, and they do have right to be concerned. And we don't look for weight loss in children before puberty. We just don't. There's too much going on. I think that the most harmful thing that I've seen parents do is talking between themselves and making comments like, did you see this person? She's as big as a house. Or weighing yourself in front of your child and then crying, and your child is seeing this whole thing. These are things that we need to avoid. And those are pretty direct. But even if adults are talking to each other, kids can hear. And what you are expressing when you talk, never mind to whoever you're talking to, you're expressing your values. And if you're talking about physical attributes, then you're showing people that those are where your values are. And then you're showing your kids that. And they'll take on those values.
And it happens a lot in schools as well. Schools are a big problem with weight stigma and weight bullying, what goes on in classrooms, what happens with kids. I hear also a lot about that. And that is really, really difficult for a child to feel like they should be in a safe place. And yet there's a lot of ridicule. There's a lot of teachers who talk about diets amongst themselves and go on their own diets. This happens very early. Like Lisa was saying, I heard a story of a teacher in first grade whose first grade students were all throwing their lunches away. And so she said to them, you know, what's going on? Why are you throwing your lunches away? And they said, well, we want to be skinny, so we're throwing our lunches away. Are first graders. This starts very, very young. It's really important how you speak to your children, and what you do is done from a very young age.
I think one of the best ways you can help your child is to help yourself.
If people don't have children yet that are on this call or will be watching it later, it sounds to me like the adults need to change the relationship with their body themselves. And then because we serve as mirrors or as models for other people, because it sounds like when people say things casually in front of other people, it causes enormous hurt that we're making judgments about a body that you were born with. It's, you know, I think people don't understand that you don't get a choice with what body you're put in. This is it. And you can make it as good as it can be, but your body is you, your eye color, your hair color. Well, your hair color can change, but I'm just saying different aspects that make you you are sometimes the things that the people fight the most against. And it's so painful to see this. So the things that I've taken away just from this little bit of the conversation here is change your relationship with yourself and appreciate your body. And then once you're able to do that, then it's time to look at the way you nourish yourself. And nourishing yourself isn't just necessarily with food. It's who you're hanging out with and what kind of a life you're leading, so that everything together, that your meals become a pleasurable and a nutritious event. So are there other, a nutritional event, because that's what it is. It's a tool. Yeah. It's not, I think I told you the story of a friend of mine whose son was a little baby and he injured his knee, and she gave him a cookie, and he put the cookie on his boo-boo. He didn't realize the cookie was there to comfort him. And but food is not a comfort. He needed a Band-Aid and a kiss, maybe. So let's go to the last question about, it's hard for us to control our thoughts. Like when we see people in 10 seconds or less, we make judgments, how hygienic they are. You know, are they male or female or intersex? You know, like we're able to make very quick judgments about people. And a lot of times we have our own little, we'll say prejudices, but we can work past it. We don't have to say it. We don't have to say it out loud. But what are other tools that we can do to create a healthy environment for ourselves and for our families that make it easier to do these very hard tasks about learning to appreciate ourselves and to be able to feed ourselves appropriately? Are there other tools that we have in our brilliant panel toolbox?
Oh, I mean, I think it's really having a greater focus on internality and not constantly referring to how things look and materials. Mm.
Which is why it's so important to have the conversation with your children about social media and the dangers of social media and the dangers of comparison. Sometimes in our communities, we don't like to admit that we might have some struggles with social media in certain ways, but it's a very toxic environment. And your children are getting on younger and they're very technologically savvy. Like you were saying, you wanted a 12-year-old to fix our technology problem. They get this very young. So it's your job to help them navigate the messages that they're seeing. You know, you might not be able to fix your body first. I'm saying, you know, you kind of have to do all these things at the same time, try to work, not judging people on their appearance and trying to work on using food in the right way. And at the same time, trying to get help for your own body image issues. But again, having these conversations with your daughter, both children, your daughters and sons, of course, when you make it a secret, when you don't let them know that you're aware of some of the dangers that come with it, and they only show the physical parts of everything, et cetera, then they won't come to you if they have a problem, because they're going to think you can't understand it. You don't know it. It's not something that you have any knowledge about. Whereas this way, you'll have opened a dialogue with them. And that's really important.
So that's great. Like, notice what's in everybody's, we'll say, environment. It's not just your own environment. It's who you're allowing into your emotional and mental space with social media, or even who they're hanging out with, you know, because that also has a huge impact on what they'll feel about themselves and consequently how that will affect you. Yaffe, do you have any takeaways for people in reference to how they can create a healthy lifestyle?
Yeah, the first things, I want to start with two like sound bitey type of things. Okay.
Okay.
If you eat like me, you will not look like me.
Ooh.
Okay. A lot of people are under the assumption that if you want to look like me, just eat like me. In fact, this whole Blue Zones book, the whole Blue Zones concept was finding areas in the world that had a higher than normal amount of people who lived over the age of 100. And they found all of these factors that contributed to their longer lives, but they just distilled it down to diet. in the original research, they were talking about community support and familial bonds and all kinds of different things, but society took it and turned it into a diet. We have to look at health in a more comprehensive way, because when we look at only the physical, we burn out. Okay, so the second thing is that healthy bodies come in all sizes. We're going to reword health at every size to healthy bodies come in all sizes. That sometimes healthy habits don't affect the scale, and sometimes they do. But that's not the reason you do them. You do them for all the other reasons. You do them for the blood panel, and you do them for the energy and all the other things. In order to make your house, your general environment, a positive place for positive health, I would say make available foods that are nutritious. You know, have a big fruit bowl on the counter with some nice fruit that people can just grab. Have some nuts out, you know, unless people are allergic to nuts, because then that's a bad idea. Yeah. But make things available. Also, shift your culture away from food in that, you know, stop using food as a reward for things. Maybe bring some activity into your family. Go on bike rides together, or here in Arizona, a lot of people go hiking. Bring some activity into your life as a family so that not everything happens around the dining room table. And that those are ways that you can positively impact yourself and those around you by adding to your life rather than taking away. We don't take away the trip to Baskin Robbins. We go on the trip to Baskin Robbins. We're just also going hiking. We're also, you know, going on our bike ride around the neighborhood.
That sounds fantastic, because what you're saying is, instead of pizza being the family focus, we're going to do an activity as a family. And so that creates even a deeper bond, because face it, when we're eating, we can't really be talking and sharing things unless
sharing things while biking either. But
true,
you know, and you can still have the pizza, and it's not biking because you had pizza. It's because biking is fun and because pizza is tasty. We don't have to interweave everything.
They can be their own standalones, is what you're saying.
Yes. When my twins, I have twin boys, they are 9 years old. Thank God they had a bris on the same day. Oh, I do not want to go back in time to that day, but we had to separate them by 15 minutes because you don't put a simcha on top of a simcha, because every simcha should have its own space and time. So the pizza and the bike ride, both simchas have their own space and time where we can appreciate them both for what they are.
I love how you explained that with a little bit of space in between what was a very big day in your life. Mm-hmm. But that makes perfect sense. So it's not just that we're changing the dynamic in our home by the way we're approaching our bodies. We're making sure that everything that we take in is wholesome or appropriate for us, whether it's social media or any other type of media or relationships that we have with people that may be upsetting to us. So we put limits. We make sure that when we go to the pediatrician, if we have a concern, we don't do it in front of the child, so we don't embarrass the child or cause the child any more harm. Or we come prepared to advocate for our child if there definitely is something wrong that is not weight related. And the same goes definitely for ourselves. And then lastly, what you're saying is create experiences that is in conjunction with treats, that we can have all of these things as a holistic approach to our bodies. So we're approaching that time. I've gotten a few questions, but pretty much all of them have been answered, and I don't see any new questions in the chat box. So we're going to close out with this last thought, and then Yafi has prepared and distilled for us. There she is with her fur baby. And I'm sure that fur baby eats a very lovely diet in a wholesome way.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Which is, any kind of dietary weight loss is usually not sustainable. It's rarely sustainable. So if you focus on a long-term, you know, habit and you stick with over time and that you do it in a way that involves the whole family or your close ones, and you make it an enjoyable experience with however way you're going to do it, that will likely result in your body being as healthy as it could be. Like you were saying, healthy, not health at. In other words, like we all said, and Dr. Minkin had said, Elisa had said, that there's, just because there's all these indicators doesn't mean that they're not healthy. They could be a certain weight and be healthy, or be very thin and unhealthy. So do any of you have any last words to say to the audience before we sign off for the night?
But I will also say, though, that you can over time lose weight. I think when we say that diets don't work, it doesn't mean that you can never lose weight. I don't want to leave with that very depressing and untrue message. I think the key is to have sustainable changes and to focus on the healthy habits or the health promoting behaviors. And I would say, do it with joy. You know, this shouldn't be like a drudgery, right? It should be something that, you know, we love to eat, and we love to eat healthy food, and we love to move. These are all things that we can do ourselves and model for our kids.
And I guess I would end with two things. One is, I just like to say that weight comes from a lot of places. We haven't talked about the fact that weight doesn't only come from how much you exercise and what you put in your body. It comes from, you know, your genes, your stress levels, your sleep levels, your socioeconomic status, medications you might be on, illnesses you might be experiencing, life stage that you might be in. There are so many factors to your actual weight. It isn't only about calories in and calories out. That's only one part of what makes up your weight. And I think it's really important for everyone to understand that everyone's journey with their body is very unique and very personal. And when we focus only on our physical appearance and our weight and our shape, whether we do that in a positive or negative way, it doesn't serve us. It's not constructive. We have to focus on, with ourselves and with our children, on what really matters: their mitos, their talents, their abilities, their capabilities, their character traits. So I think that these are the things that we have to focus on, and we have to make it less about, you know, that physical appearance or complimenting people on that.
Yaffe posted a little picture for you in the chat box, if you're interested, that shows some lovely penguins on top of a little tiny iceberg. But just below are all the things that Marcy said so eloquently that have a huge impact, an outsized impact, actually, on your weight. It's not just your weight, as she said. It's so many more things. So you can check it in the chat box as well as the other two flyers that we were talking about. And Yaffe, you're the last one to give us some words of wisdom before we go
out with a bang. You know, food through joy. Eat happy and have health through joy. We have to cultivate gratitude. We have to cultivate optimism and compassion for those around us and for ourselves. And when we can model that for our kids, for our neighbors, for our kitty cats, we're just going to increase in so much happiness. You know, all of these conversations, everything we're talking about, there's the biology and there's the psychology, but there isn't really a division between them. They're joined in cascades of hormones that they both affect back and forth. And there's interplay with the gut microbiome. And we have such a complex and amazing system that we're working with. We don't know everything about it, but we do know that certain things can increase our happiness. And having lots of plants in our diet, spending time outside, and spending enjoyable time with friends and family all contribute to a long, happy life. So we need to focus more on that and less on the little things.
Thank you so much, everybody. The recording will be available on the JOMA website, I believe, and it will be also available on Yaffe's and Marcy's socials. So we will put links to that in, I think, Instagram and some other social media sites, so you can check back. If you missed part of it, you can see it again. You can watch it as many times as you like. Each time, sometimes you might hear something different, and it might motivate you to make permanent and lasting healthy changes for yourself and your family. Thank you again for joining us. And thank you to this wonderful, brilliant panel of amazing women and we hope to see you next time. Thank you so much for joining us and have a wonderful night.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.